Mike Oitala is the executive editor of Soccer America, and he joins us occasionally to keep us abreast of what's going on in soccer in the U.S. and around the world. And increasingly, the U.S. has a presence in soccer around the world. And as you all know, the World Cup will be here and in Canada and Mexico in 2026. Mike, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, John.
So there is lots of news going on, and we'll talk a little bit about FIFA and what they decided and made official this week. But I think, honestly, we'd be burying the lead if we didn't talk about the Berhalter-Reyna kerfuffle that's been going on. A report was released just a few days ago regarding the I don't even know how you describe it. Maybe you can help me describe it. The disclaimer
the
here is Reyna that
affair, the Berhalter-Reyna scandal, a very, very sad episode in American soccer history. You know, this happened when Claudio Reyna and Danielle, his wife, got very upset because Gio, their 20-year-old son, wasn't getting playing time at the World Cup. A team coached by Greg Berhalter, with whom Claudio Reyna grew up with, played club soccer with, high school soccer with, played in two World Cups with, whose wife, Rosalyn, played college soccer with Danielle at North Carolina, where they were roommates. The good news is that it's done, in the sense that the Federation's investigation, or the investigation that it had done by a law firm, came out. It detailed all the bad behavior, but the ruled there were no legal violations, so Greg Berhalter could be rehired if that's what they want to do. And Gio Reyna is back with the national team for these upcoming games.
So essentially, what did the report determine about the role played by the Reynas in the report that they made to U.S. Soccer about an incident that Greg Berhalter had with his wife that he had admitted that happened, gosh, was it 30 years ago?
Yeah, it was in 1992 when we were 18. It was a... because there was an incident that would probably never have come up. They'd been married for 25 years now. But it was reported that there was a veiled threat, or a not so veiled threat, that that they would tell people about this incident. The Reynas would tell people about this incident if Gio didn't play. It's not exactly how it ended up coming out, although it's pretty clear that that insinuation was there. The investigation ruled that it was not blackmail or extortion. There was not a legal issue because they weren't asking for something back in the sense of money or anything. And it came out after the World Cup. But just an example of what a messy situation this was. But because Danielle told Ernie Stewart of the U.S. Soccer Federation that he had to report it to U.S. Soccer, and that prompted the investigation by the independent law firm, and that investigation then was expanded to investigate the Reynas in the way that they treated U.S. soccer officials, basically badgering them. And then it turned out that Claudio had been doing that for years. Claudio had worked for the Federation at one point. But it turns out that back at the U17 World Cup in 2019, he was constantly texting the head coach of the, he was texting people at the Federation complaining about Gio's playing time and about how the coach was so bad. Even a detail such as complaining to the Federation that his son had to play in a game that was refereed by a woman. There was one where he had emailed the Federation where he wanted a youth red card overturned for Gio. So it just was not a good situation. I mean, it did not shed a good light on how Claudio had been behaving over the last few years, which is really a shame, because he was one of the greatest players that the U.S. had ever seen. And certainly his playing career, he had never showed any type of misbehavior.
And the disclaimer here is that you wrote a book with Claudio, gosh, it's been almost 20 years ago, I guess, titled More Than Goals.
And, I ended up getting to know the family quite well. Back in 2002, I'd been contacted by a publisher who did how-to books, and I suggested instead of doing a book about drills and 100 and something drills, you know, find a player who kind of represents what the modern American soccer player is, you know, have a Latin influence in it, because that's always been lacking. And so instead of doing a straightforward how-to, it was more about how Claudio grew up and had his father's Argentine influence and would play in the backyard with his brother and, you know, played for coaches like Bruce Arena and Bob Bradley and, you know, went to Germany, played in World Cups. So it was sort of a, you know, learn by seeing what someone does on and off the field. You know, what I look back on it, you know, I remember at the time talking to Claudio about, you know, we would laugh about parents being too involved in their kids' careers and even when they were older. So it was a real, you know, it was shocking that he ended up being like that. But, he has had a tough life because his oldest son, Jackson, died when he was 13 years old of cancer in 2012. And I imagine that had to have had, horrifying effect on the family. And I think that may have influenced their behavior. And then Claudio's brother died of COVID, and then his uncle died of COVID. So, you know, there are off-field things there that happened that may not excuse, but they may explain some of the behavior.
So how then do you view the Reinas, having known them for a long time and gotten to know them very well? How do you view what's happened and possibly the legacy that Claudio now has that may be irreparable?
It's sad. I mean, this comes up in other sports when, it turns out that a Hall of Famer might not have another part of his life might not be Hall of Famish. But I think, you know, with Claudio, I'll always remember him as a player. He was a stylish player, a clever player, a smart player. And that's not going to go away. I'm hoping over time that, you know, that he gets, I don't know. It's a tough question. It was sad when the news was happening. It's still sad. And, you know, I would always kind of wake up and thinking it was just a bad dream and, you know, maybe people could say sorry and move on. But, the report was just it's a sad thing that these things came out and that these things happened.
How have you all reported this? And how is it, you know, how would you describe the tenor of your reporting in Soccer America?
Well, when the rumors came out, you know, we're a traditional news organization. We only report what we can verify. So we depended on, things that were on the record. We started hearing things off the record pretty early on. You know, Eric Winalda leaked something on Twitter about Claudio being upset. Eric Winalda, as anybody who knows him, might not be always a reliable source in the sense that he shoots from the hip, but it turned out that it was true what he had reported about Claudio being upset. And, once Greg Berhalter put a statement, you know, I have to say that the way that Greg Berhalter handled this situation was, you know, was impressive and created and made him an empathetic, figure in this. What had happened when he was 18 was regrettable, but his reaction to it, I think, was as good as you could expect from anybody. And he shouldn't have had to go through this at this point in his life. And as he explained very well, it should have been up to his wife to decide whether this was a public issue or not. And basically, kind of that's how we, you know, we basically reported pretty straightforward. You know, I haven't written about what I just told you about my relationship with him. I've contemplated it a number of times, and maybe in the future I will. One of the angles I've thought of is this reaction to it, like it was you know, a example of helicopter parenting. And I don't really think that's true. I mean, I get why people make that comparison, but I think this was a unique, perfect storm of just, you know, one thing I should point out is that a problem at the World Cup was that Greg and Claudio were friends and World Cup teammates, and so was the sporting director, Ernie Stewart, and so was the general manager, Brian McBride. They had been friends. They had been on the 2002 World Cup team. That is not a good situation. That just makes it much more difficult. You needed a new person in there that wasn't emotionally attached to this, you know, to the entire situation.
How does this impact Berhalter's future? Does he still have a chance to be rehired as the coach?
Absolutely. I mean, I would put him as a favorite right now. My first prediction would have been that he maybe get a 2-year contract through the Copa America, which would be the really big tournament 2 years before the World Cup. You know, there's a lot of questions. The Federation won't hire a coach until after the summer, and in a way, there's not a big rush. Anthony Hudson, an interim coach, can take care of the things for now, like the Gold Cup or the Nations League Cup that are going on right now. After they hire a sporting director, then they'll have that person lead the hiring process. I think Greg has a future. I don't know if he will be the U.S. national team coach, but I think there's a good chance. And if he's not, then I'm sure he'll coach some in some other capacity.
He'll get a job.
Absolutely.
Mike Watala is the executive editor of Soccer America. He's with us on Watch the Media. Let's pivot now to the World Cup in 2026. FIFA made it official this week that there will be 104 games played, most of them in the U.S., some in Mexico, and some in Canada. But there'll be 12 groups of four teams each. Can you help break this down for us, how this is going to work when it comes, well, understand when it comes to pool play, but what happens after that in 26?
Well, so the magic number is 30. Yeah. The magic number is 32, right? So you can have a bracket. The great thing about the last World Cup and the World Cups since 98 was that you had 32 teams. You had the teams that brought you into a situation where only the first two teams of each group went through. At the 2026 World Cup, what you'll have to have is 8 third place finishers join the knockout stage. So besides adding so many extra games and making the World Cup be more than, you know, 5 weeks, you won't have the drama that we enjoyed in Qatar, where the games on the last day were so exciting because they decided it. When you have third place teams going through, you can tie your way through to the second round. You know, there have been cases of teams not winning and going to the second round. So, and I think probably the biggest point of this is just greed. Is just that, first of all, I don't think the World Cup needed to be expanded to so many teams. And I don't think it's such, and to be as long. I mean, we enjoyed the World Cup. I think I'm assuming you enjoyed the last World Cup. But it was pretty arduous.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't working it, and it was. I wasn't working it, and it was a long haul.
But you know, it's not just that. It's also that they expanded the Club World Cup. FIFA did to 16 teams now, or they're just trying to get more money any possible way they can, and the calendar is already too crowded for players. On the one hand, they talk about player welfare, and on the other hand, they just keep adding games and games and games. So I mean, usually World Cups turn out to be good. Obviously, we're all looking forward to it in the United States. It's going to be great for American soccer, and I'm, you know, we're all looking forward to it. But right now, it just seems sort of daunting that they're making it so big.
Well, and I talked about the USA, Mexico, and Canada. 11 stadiums in the U.S., 3 stadiums in Mexico, and 2 stadiums in Canada will be used. And we're not talking about 18,000 seat MLS stadiums. We're talking about these football stadiums, these 70 to 80,000. And in Dallas, 100,000. In Los Angeles, what do they hold? 70,000 at SoFi.
Yeah.
So we're talking about what will clearly be, even though FIFA wouldn't share this information with us, Mike, this is going to be absolutely the greatest revenue generating event, maybe in the history of humankind when it comes to sports.
Absolutely. Well, you know, when the U.S. hosted the 1994 World Cup, and remember that was before, 2 years before MLS launched, that still holds the record for the best attended World Cup in history, even though it had fewer games than all the World Cups afterward, because our stadiums are so big and we have a population and a demographic that every team has following here, even without traveling teams. The big difference in this one is, you know, it's FIFA is running it and controlling it and going to control the profits. At the after the 1994 World Cup, when the U.S. Soccer Federation, or let's call it the U.S. Soccer Foundation, they got $50 million out of it, which has been used in perpetuity to fund programs of various kinds around the country. You know, it still does. It's a fantastic issue, but the FIFA is much more in control of this one. That doesn't mean that it's not going to benefit the U.S. It will financially. It'll benefit American soccer in a lot of ways, financially and otherwise. But yeah, you're right. The magnitude of it is incredible, and it does remind me as we talk about it how much fun the '94 World Cup was, and just seeing people who, no matter what their interest in soccer was, even if it was zero, you know, at that point, I think fewer people really were as knowledgeable about soccer as they are now in the United States. But one thing I think you're reminding me of, before the 94 World Cup, American sports viewers were not used to or never experienced sports on TV without commercial breaks. That, you know, back then, and that was kind of before the, you know, now you get all these streaming situations, but before, back then, the only kind of TV you ever got to watch that didn't have commercial breaks was maybe PBS, or C-SPAN. And people go, wow, this is kind of neat, watching 45 minutes of a sport and to experience the rhythm of it. That was kind of a big thing in American soccer.
So FIFA also announced this week that they are more than tripling, if I did my math correct, the amount of money that will be paid out to the Women's World Cup teams in Australia, New Zealand here in 2023. I think roughly it was $35 million that was paid out to the teams in 2019, and they're going over $100 million this year, which is still, I think, what, less than 25%. Of what the men get. And Infantino had some interesting comments about that. First, I'll ask you a response to that, and on the right path, but is it the right decision, do you think?
Well, I don't think you can ignore the revenue aspect of it, right? There's a reason why it's not just about gender. It's also about the revenue. But seeing that FIFA is, you know, has oceans of money, there's no reason why they shouldn't take the lead on this and subsidize those bonuses. And there are obviously income. The revenues have increased for women's soccer, and they'll continue to do so. And the situation with FIFA support of the women's soccer, you know, that kind of came from the bottom up. That wasn't led by them. And to FIFA's credit, you can't just, they did expand the back in, I think it was the Canada World Cup in 2015, where they expanded the field, and then they did it again. And the important thing about that is you may have had teams at that World Cup that weren't really, world-class teams, but it was the only way in many of these countries to get them to support women's soccer. I mean, the Brazilian team, the tradition with them is the women get ignored until there's a World Cup you know, if they had the kind of support the U.S. did, you have countries like Jamaica, where Lauren Donaldson, who's a Jamaican-American from Colorado, coaching that team, you know, they have to, they struggle for every dollar they get. And if there wasn't a World Cup, there would be nothing for girls in Jamaica when it comes to, you know, soccer. So it is a pretty positive growth of the women's game through the World Cup. I don't think there's any other way you could influence the game the way a World Cup can.
Yeah. And Infantino said he laid some of the blame, and I don't know if those were his words. Infantino's the, I guess the president is his title of FIFA, got elected to his third term, his second full term, and he's now in his third term. He took over in his first term for right. Sepp Blatter, who was fired in disgrace. But Infantino basically laid it on the media rights holders, which in one sense you can say, yes, they should pay more because their ratings are more than 25% of what the men are getting. Maybe they're not 100%, certainly. But also it's FIFA who sets the media rights, right? It's FIFA who says this is how much money we want. So help sort that out for me. What role television media rights play in this?
One problem, though, is the timing of the games being in New Zealand and Australia, and when they would air in Europe, I believe, would be the excuse of the broadcasters. But I do think that, you know, the market is the market. You can't, you know, you can't Title IX free enterprise. But again, FIFA has the money from all its revenue that it gets from the men's side that no one's going to miss if they throw more tens of millions at the women's game, which would be the right thing to do. No one's going to miss that.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen it in this country, enhanced resources have helped. You mentioned Title IX. That certainly was a factor in the U.S. being one of the early world powers. Maybe the world power along with China and a couple of other countries in the early days of the Women's World Cup in 1991 is when it started. So certainly the resources that could put in there, and essentially you call it whatever you want. FIFA could subsidize it. They could invest in it. You could really call it whatever you want, but they certainly could put more money into it and will, and maybe they have grudgingly, but they certainly are much better. Mike Waitala is the executive editor of Soccer America. You can find Soccer America at socceramerica.com. I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media. In the time we have to talk, I think it would be certainly remiss if we didn't talk about our late friend Grant Wall, who passed away in Qatar in the World Cup. And give me an idea, if you would, about the impact that a journalist, Grant Wall, had on American soccer and maybe the way we see soccer in America and maybe in some parts of the world.
Well, Grant was, besides being an excellent writer, an excellent investigative journalist, he was working for Sports Illustrated, which at that time was, you know, the Bible of sports in America. And it's always been important for soccer to get that kind of mainstream coverage. And it never, you know, it never got it close to the extent that Grant gave it. And it was also traditionally, and you probably have had experience of your own in this, that would have been driven by him more than by his bosses, right? It wasn't like Sports Illustrated told him, hey, go do all this stuff in soccer. It was Grant's initiative. And he covered so much of the game, so many different assets, parts of it, that his contribution was invaluable to the evolution of American soccer. That he died at such a young age, you know, it was so shocking. And I guess the only silver lining is that it made us all reflect on, you know, on what he did and what we do and how far soccer has come along. You know, it's you know, he was a fantastic journalist, and as we know, that's important no matter what the subject is.
Yeah, and I mean, I had just had a conversation with him a few weeks before the World Cup. We had done an interview. I know a lot of people have spent a lot of time talking with him over the years about this. I mean, your contribution, your publication is what, more than 50 years old now, is that right? You guys have been around for, you know, since the game was invented. I'm joking about that, but you've been around basically since the game became largely aware by people in the U.S. So I don't think we can, in this conversation, ignore the fact that Soccer America has played a very large role in the reporting of soccer. But when something like that happens, it's like you think, wow, a journalist, and sometimes a guy who could be tough, and a guy who made some serious social commentary in Qatar before and during his time there, and makes you sort of reflect on what we do as journalists and the impact that we can have on the business. Is that how you sort of self-reflected? You mentioned you self-reflected on this.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's also something that really hit home during the, you know, during COVID, what that over, you know, overlap with Black Lives Matter and a lot of social justice issues. And what we kind of, you know, what really hit home during that time is how important a role has in those issues, you know, for different reasons. One is because sports reflect society, that's just natural, but also because the athletes themselves, especially in soccer, but in other sports as well, but especially in soccer, you know, they ply their trade among a group of diverse colleagues from all different walks, you know, all different backgrounds. And it's a meritocracy. You don't last if you're not good, and you don't succeed if you don't get along. So the experiences that professional athletes have are, you know, are unique in many ways, and they are actually in a good position, you know, to comment on and have a role in social justice issues, and journalists help that make an impact.
Yeah, well spoken. Thanks. I appreciate it. One final topic I want to touch on here is, look at the investment that clubs have made around the world in women's soccer. Barcelona's had a couple of crowds of 85,000-90,000 people for their club matches. It was in Spain last year when the European Championships were going on, and it was a really big deal, well talked about. The NWSL in the U.S. is the American league, is the North American league for women's soccer. And give me an idea of where that fits in, because it just seems like a team that's won as many World Cups as the U.S. has, a country that's won as many gold medals as the United States has, still seems to be struggling a bit trying to get a full footing of a women's professional soccer league. Put that in context for me, if you would, please.
MLS has 29 teams now, and it's been around since 1996, and only maybe four or five make a profit, right? So the, you know, there's other ways that they are able to be successful, the way the math works and the way the clubs are assessed and the way the owners own their stadiums. It took a long time to get to that. And every single challenge that men's professional soccer has had in this country, the women have, and more so. And that includes the fact that in the United States, we have a almost infinite amount of entertainment opportunities beyond just all the other sports. You also have the challenges of the costs of the travel. We're a huge country. It's an expensive thing to have a professional league. I think the best model for women's sports could be something like the WNBA or the Mexican Women's League, where the men's clubs support and subsidize the women's game as it grows, and which can be a financial benefit to them as well. I'm sure one of the reasons Mexican League got the support it did is because the sponsors recognized that that is a good marketing, good marketing pathway or whatever you call it. But the MLS teams are not in a financial situation right now where they're going to invest in the women's game. You know, besides a couple of examples, like up in Portland, which happens to be a team that has been beleaguered by all kinds of issues, and you know, ostracized and criticized for some things that happened there. At the same time, they were probably the most successful women's club in the entire world, right? So it's a lot of challenges. And they basically need rich people to support something that is not going to be profitable, and you can't force people to go to games. And it's always, and all of us who've been fans know what it's like. You don't become a fan of a team that just, you know, overnight. You know, it's soccer here. When there's a new team, it takes years and years and years to create allegiances. So that's among the challenges. And right now, I think the NWSL, you know, does have a lot of challenges. They've had issues with, you know, their coach, you know, how many coaches gotten fired. To its credit, it's been around for a long time. And it hasn't, you know, no other league lasted more than 3 years. So that longevity, I think, you know, speaks well of it. And, you know, we'll just have to see. But sooner, you know, it's going to have to grow. It's going to have to create a product that will get people to go to the games.
So are you optimistic?
That's a tough question. You know, besides a couple teams, the crowds are still kind of small. It takes patience. Basically, if you have an owner who can, you know, who you know is going to be in it for the long term, who can lose, you know, $5, $10, $15 million a year, then and for better or for worse, there's a lot of people in this country for whom that's not a lot of money. And I do think there are a lot of people who realize that it is a, you know, it is a game and an investment that can be worthwhile. So in that case, I think there are reasons to see it, to be optimistic. It takes a lot of commitment. And they do need to get some things in order. They need to create it so that coaches aren't scared to coach in the league. I'm not in any way belittling or dismissing the importance of investigating any kind of misbehavior. But right now it's a situation where coaches are reluctant to take a job in the NWSL, and you know, it needs to find some stability, and I think maybe the first steps to that have been taken, and it's kind of like a clean slate maybe, and hopefully we move on from the off the field problems and be able to focus on the field.
Well, in one sense, I'm encouraged overall for American soccer, because the people who are investing in it now, especially MLS teams, many of whom are wildly wealthy, are incredibly wealthy people who have invested in MLS teams, and the value of their teams has increased immensely. And so maybe that's an encouraging sign that maybe the investment of women's soccer will be the next move. I don't know. Hope so. Hopefully.
Two experiences I had in the last year, I think, I found profound. One was MLS Cup with LAFC hosting Philadelphia in an incredible atmosphere. And I had to really, really think back. And I've been in this game for a long, long time, of being in a stadium with that kind of atmosphere. It was absolutely tremendous, nonstops. It was a wonderful, joyful atmosphere. I could recall a Boca Juniors game I went to that was like that. Maybe a Borussia Dortmund game I like it. Absolutely amazing. And then more recently, I went to the U.S. women's game in Frisco, Texas, against Brazil. It was a very different kind of crowd. It was a very uncritical crowd. You know, they were so supportive of the U.S. team. They won, even if they lost, I think they would have got a standing ovation. But there was also something really remarkable and joyful about that atmosphere as well. You just felt good walking around and seeing, whether it was young girls or whether it was men, it was incredibly festive, just you know, feel good type of atmosphere in a different way than MLS Cup was. But also, you know, just when it comes to soccer, in both cases, examples of why we love the sport.
Yeah, and as we close this off, we'll just remind people that, well, I mentioned that the Women's World Cup is only now 32 years old, right? First one was in 1991. The first Men's World Cup was in 1930. The USA didn't even have a professional league in men's until 1996. And even then, we were lucky it didn't fold in 98 or 99 or 2000. Yeah. A couple of very wealthy people, including Phil Anschutz, kept it together while more investment was being made. So in the big picture, Mike, we're really talking about infant businesses, and the fact that it's come this far in 30 years has been remarkable. And I've been lucky enough, and I know you have too, to watch it grow, and it's been exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And also because it's a sport that I think does what no other sport does, is bring so many different types of people together, you know.
Yeah, just it really does.
Incredibly you know, at its best, it's just a, you know, a fun type of experience in many cases when it comes to soccer.
Well, thank you as always for helping us understand some of these things and keeping us up to date on what's going on, Mike. I appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. I always enjoy talking to you, John.
Thanks, Mike. Mike Watala is the executive editor of Soccer America, and you can find it at socceramerica.com, and I recommend it. I'm John Schrader, and this is Watch the Media.